This is Audible.
Where Wizards Stay Up Late: The Origins of the Internet. Written by Katie Hafner and Matthew Lyon. Narrated by Mark Douglas Nelson. Prologue. September 1994. They came to Boston from as far away as London and Los Angeles, several dozen middle-aged men, reuniting for a fall weekend in 1994 to celebrate what they had done 25 years earlier. These were the scientists and engineers who had designed and built the ARPANET, the computer network that revolutionized communications and gave rise to the global Internet. They had worked in relative obscurity in the 1960s. A number of them had been only graduate students when they made significant contributions to the network. Others had been mentors. Most of them had never gained much recognition for the achievement. Bolt, Baranek, and Newman, a computer company based in Cambridge, had been their center of gravity, had employed many of them, had built and operated the original ARPA network, then slipped into relative obscurity as the Internet grew like a teeming city around its earliest neighborhood. Now, a quarter century after installing the first network node, BBN had invited all of the ARPANET pioneers to come together, hoping to heighten its own profile by throwing a lavish celebration marking the anniversary. Many of those at the reunion hadn't seen one another or been in touch for years. As they filtered into the lobby of the Copley Plaza for a Friday afternoon press conference kicking off the celebration, they scanned the room for familiar faces. Bob Taylor, the director of a corporate research facility in Silicon Valley, had come to the party for old time's sake, but he was also on a personal mission to correct an inaccuracy of long standing. Rumors had persisted for years that the ARPANET had been built to protect national security in the face of a nuclear attack. It was a myth that had gone unchallenged long enough to become widely accepted as fact. Taylor had been the young director of the office within the Defense Department's Advanced Research Projects Agency overseeing computer research, and he was the one who had started the ARPANET. The project had embodied the most peaceful intentions: to link computers at scientific laboratories across the country, so that researchers might share computer resources. Taylor knew the ARPANET and its progeny, the Internet, had nothing to do with supporting or surviving war. Never did. Yet he felt fairly alone in carrying that knowledge. Lately, the mainstream press had picked up the grim myth of a nuclear survival scenario and had presented it as an established truth. When Time magazine committed the error, Taylor wrote a letter to the editor, but the magazine didn't print it. The effort to set the record straight was like chasing the wind. Taylor was beginning to feel like a crank. Across the room at dinner that night at the Copley, Taylor spotted an elderly, heavy-set man with a thick mustache. He recognized him immediately as the one person who could convincingly corroborate his story. It was his old boss, Charlie Hertzfeld, who had been the director of ARPA when Taylor worked there. The two men had last seen each other years earlier, before anyone else cared about how the network began. Seeing Hertzfeld now, Taylor was buoyed. He was back among the people who knew the real story. Now they'd straighten things out. Chapter 1. The Fastest $1 Million. February 1966. Bob Taylor usually drove to work, 30 minutes through the rolling countryside northeast of Washington, over the Potomac River to the Pentagon. There, in the morning, he'd pull into one of the vast parking lots and try to put his most prized possession, a BMW 503, someplace he could remember. There were few, if any, security checkpoints at the entrances to the Pentagon in 1966. Taylor breezed in, wearing his usual attire: sport coat, tie, button-down short-sleeve shirt, and slacks. 30,000 other people swarmed through the concourse level daily, in uniform and mufti alike, past the shops and up into the warrens of the enormous building. Taylor's office was on the third floor, the most prestigious level in the Pentagon, near the offices of the Secretary of Defense and the Director of the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA. The offices of the highest-ranking officials in the Pentagon were in the outer, or E-ring. Their suites had views of the river and national monuments. Taylor's boss, Charles Hertzfeld, the head of ARPA, was among those with a view, in room 3E-160. The ARPA director rated the highest symbols of power meted out by the Department of Defense, DOD, right down to the official flags beside his desk. Taylor was director of the Information Processing Techniques Office, or IPTO, just a corridor away, an unusually independent section of ARPA charged with supporting the nation's most advanced computer research and development projects. The IPTO director's suite, where Taylor hung his coat from 1965 to 1969, was located in the D-ring. What his office lacked in a view was compensated for by its comfort and size. It was a plushly carpeted and richly furnished room with a big desk, a heavy oak conference table, glass-fronted bookcases, comfortable leather chairs, and all the other trappings of rank, which the Pentagon carefully measured out even down to the quality of the ashtrays. Traveling on military business, Taylor carried the rank of one-star general. On one wall of his office was a large map of the world. A framed temple rubbing from Thailand hung prominently on another. Inside the suite, beside Taylor's office, was another door leading to a small space referred to as the terminal room. There, side by side, sat three computer terminals, each a different make, each connected to a separate mainframe computer running at three separate sites. There was a modified IBM Selectric typewriter terminal connected to a computer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge. A Model 33 teletype terminal, resembling a metal desk with a large noisy typewriter embedded in it, was linked to a computer at the University of California in Berkeley. And another teletype terminal, a Model 35, was dedicated to a computer in Santa Monica, California, called, cryptically enough, the AN/FSQ32XD1A, nicknamed the Q32, a hulking machine built by IBM for the Strategic Air Command. Each of the terminals in Taylor's suite was an extension of a different computing environment, different programming languages, operating systems, and the like, within each of the distant mainframes. Each had a different login procedure. Taylor knew them all. But he found it irksome to have to remember which login procedure to use for which computer. And it was still more irksome, after he logged in, to be forced to remember which commands belonged to which computing environment. This was a particularly frustrating routine when he was in a hurry, which was most of the time. The presence of three different computer terminals in Taylor's Pentagon office reflected IPTO's strong connection to the leading edge of the computer research community, resident in a few of the nation's top universities and technical centers. In all, there were some 20 principal investigators, supporting dozens of graduate students, working on numerous projects, all of them funded by Taylor's small office, which consisted of just Taylor and a secretary. Most of IPTO's $19 million budget was being sent to campus laboratories in Boston and Cambridge, or out to California to support work that held the promise of making revolutionary advances in computing. Under ARPA's umbrella, a growing sense of community was emerging in computer research in the mid-1960s. Despite the wide variety of projects and computer systems, tight bonds were beginning to form among members of the computer community. Researchers saw each other at technical conferences and talked by phone. As early as 1964, some had even begun using a form of electronic mail to trade comments, within the very limited proximity of their mainframe computers. Communicating with that community from the terminal room next to Taylor's office was a tedious process. The equipment was state-of-the-art, but having a room cluttered with assorted computer terminals was like having a den cluttered with several television sets, each dedicated to a different channel. "It became obvious," Taylor said many years later, that we ought to find a way to connect all these different machines. That there even existed an agency within the Pentagon capable of supporting what some might consider esoteric academic research was a tribute to the wisdom of ARPA's earliest founders. The agency had been formed by President Dwight Eisenhower in the period of national crisis following the Soviet launch of the first Sputnik satellite in October 1957. The research agency was to be a fast response mechanism closely tied to the President and Secretary of Defense to ensure that Americans would never again be taken by surprise on the technological frontier. President Eisenhower saw ARPA fitting nicely into his strategy to stem the intense rivalries among branches of the military over research and development programs. The ARPA idea began with a man who was neither scientist nor soldier, but soap salesman. At age 52, Neil McElroy was a newcomer to the defense establishment. He had never worked in government, had never lived in Washington, and had no military experience except in the National Guard. For 32 years he had climbed the corporate ladder at Procter & Gamble, the giant soap manufacturer in Cincinnati. A Harvard graduate, McElroy took his first job at P&G slitting envelopes as a mail clerk in the advertising department for $25 a week. It was supposed to be a summer job. He had intended to enter business school in the fall. But he stayed on and began peddling soap door to door. Soon he became promotion manager. From there he worked his way up by pioneering the selling of soap on radio and television. The TV soap opera was McElroy's brainchild, about which he once said without apology, "The problem of improving literary taste is one for the schools. Soap operas sell lots of soap." By 1957, P&G was selling about $1 billion worth of Ivory, Oxydol, Joy, and Tide every year. He had perfected the strategy of promoting brand name competition, as if there were real differences between similar products made by the same company. And for the past 9 years, tall, handsome Mac, as he was known to most, or Soapy Mac from Cincio to some, had been the company's president, until Eisenhower recruited him for his cabinet. On the evening of Friday, October 4, 1957, President Eisenhower's new nominee for Secretary of Defense, McElroy, was in Huntsville, Alabama. He had already been confirmed by the Senate and was touring military installations in advance of his swearing-in. A large entourage of Pentagon staff was in tow for Mac's tour of Redstone Arsenal, home of the Army's rocket program. At about 6 o'clock in the evening in the officers' club, McElroy was talking to German émigré Werner von Braun, the father of modern rocketry, when an aide rushed up and announced that the Russians had succeeded in launching a satellite into Earth orbit. Now suddenly, even before taking office, McElroy found himself engulfed in a crisis of huge proportions. In one night, the Soviet achievement had reduced America's booming post-war confidence and optimism to widening fear and despair. Suddenly, the specter of wholesale destruction, in the President's words, bore down on the American psyche. 5 days later, McElroy was sworn in, with Washington fully consumed in controversy over the question of who had let the Soviets steal the march on American science and technology. Some people had predicted the Soviets would launch a satellite in observance of the International Geophysical Year. Their earlier preaching in the wilderness was redeemed by the Soviet scientific spectaculars, one observer said. It now took on the aura of revealed truth. "I told you so" became a status symbol. Genuine fear, ominous punditry, and harsh criticism flowed around the central issue of the new Soviet threat to national security. Hysterical prophecies of Soviet domination and the destruction of democracy were common. Sputnik was proof of Russia's ability to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles, the pessimists said, and it was just a matter of time before the Soviets would threaten the United States. The least panicked Americans were resigned to disappointment over Russia's lead in the race to explore space. Eisenhower hadn't wanted a seasoned military expert heading the Pentagon. He was one himself. The president distrusted the military-industrial complex and the fiefdoms of the armed services. His attitude toward them sometimes bordered on contempt. By contrast, he loved the scientific community. He found scientists inspiring, their ideas, their culture, their values, and their value to the country, and he surrounded himself with the nation's best scientific minds. Eisenhower was the first president to host a White House dinner specifically to single out the scientific and engineering communities as guests of honor, just as the Kennedys would later play host to artists and musicians. Hundreds of prominent American scientists directly served the Eisenhower administration on various panels. He referred to them proudly as "my scientists." "Ike liked to think of himself as one of us," observed Detlev W. Bronk, president of the National Academy of Sciences. Two prominent scientists once had breakfast with the president, and as they were leaving, Eisenhower remarked that the Republican National Committee was complaining that scientists close to him were not whooping it up sufficiently for the Republican Party. "Don't you know, Mr. President," replied one of the men with a smile, "all scientists are Democrats." "I don't believe it," Eisenhower shot back. "But anyway, I like scientists for their science and not for their politics." When the Sputnik crisis hit, Eisenhower pulled his scientists still more tightly into his circle. First, he held a number of private meetings with prominent scientists from outside the government. 11 days after the news of the Soviet satellite, on October 15, 1957, Eisenhower sat down for a lengthy discussion with his Science Advisory Committee, a full contingent of the nation's best minds. Neither he nor any of them was as concerned about the actual significance of Sputnik as were those who were using the issue against Ike. For one thing, Eisenhower knew a great deal more than he could say publicly about the status of the Russian missile programs. He had seen the exquisitely detailed spy photographs made from a U-2 spy plane. He knew there was no missile gap. He also knew that the American military and its contractors had a vested interest in the Soviet threat. Still, he asked his science advisers for their estimation of the Soviet capability. Eisenhower listened closely as they soberly assessed the meaning of the Sputnik launch. They told him the Russians had indeed gained impressive momentum. They said the United States would lose its scientific and technological lead unless it mobilized. Many of the scientists around Eisenhower had been worrying since the early 1950s that the government either misused or misunderstood modern science and technology. They urged Eisenhower to appoint a single, high-level presidential science advisor, a person he could live with easily, to help him make decisions involving technology. The launch of Sputnik 2 just a month after the first Sputnik increased the pressure. The first satellite, a 184-pound object the size of a basketball, was bad enough. Its fellow traveler weighed in at half a ton and was nearly the size of a Volkswagen Bug. A few days after the news of Sputnik 2, Eisenhower told the nation that he found his man for science in James R. Killian, Jr., president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Killian was a non-scientist who spoke effectively on behalf of science. On November 7, 1957, in the first of several addresses to reassure the American people and reduce panic, the president announced Killian's appointment as science advisor. It came late in the address but made front-page news the following day. The president had drawn links between science and defense, and said Killian would "follow through on the scientific improvement of our defense." The press dubbed Killian America's missile czar. During the October 15 meeting with his science advisors, the President had spoken of his concern over the management of research in government. "With great enthusiasm and determination, the President wanted the scientists to tell him where scientific research belonged in the structure of the federal government," said Sherman Adams, the President's executive assistant. "In addition, Eisenhower told them he had a fine man in Secretary of Defense McElroy and urged the scientists to meet with the new secretary, which they did that very day." They found that Secretary McElroy had a similar appreciation for them. One aspect of his career at P&G that he was most proud of was that the amount of money the company had devoted to research. He believed in the value of unfettered science, in its ability to produce remarkable, if not always predictable, results. McElroy and P&G had created a large Blue Sky research laboratory, had funded it well, and rarely, if ever, pressured its scientists to justify their work. It was one of the first corporate research operations of its kind, one in which scientists were left to pursue almost anything and were well supported from the top. Significant technological advances had come from a similar arrangement between universities and government during World War II. Radar, nuclear weapons, and large calculating machines resulted from what Killian called the free-willing methods of outstanding academic scientists and engineers who had always been free of any inhibiting regimentation and organization. In consultation with Killian, whose support was crucial, McElroy began discussing the idea of establishing an independent agency for research. Perhaps McElroy was aware that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce had floated the notion of creating a single research and development agency for the federal government during congressional hearings months before Sputnik. Such talk was in the air. The idea now emerged in discussions with an informal advisory committee of astute industrialists who met regularly with the Secretary of Defense. In the days immediately following the Soviet launch, two men had been to see McElroy, eminent nuclear physicist Ernest O. Lawrence and Charles Thomas, a former CEO of the Monsanto Chemical Company and an occasional advisor to the President. In a meeting lasting several hours, they discussed the idea of a strong advanced R&D agency that would report to the Secretary, and both visitors urged McElroy to run with it. The physicist Herbert York, director of the Livermore Laboratory and close confidant to both Eisenhower and Killian, joined the conversations. At the same time, McElroy himself was consulting frequently with Killian and the President. In Killian's view, the traditional missions of the armed services had been outmoded by modern science and technology. Here was a way to move the Pentagon into the new age. One of the principal attractions of the research agency concept, in McElroy's mind, was the ability it would give him to manage the fierce competition within DOD over R&D programs and budgets. The competition was reaching absurd new heights. Army, Navy, and Air Force commanders treated Sputnik like the starting gun in a new race, each vying against the other for the biggest share of R&D spending. McElroy believed that a centralized agency for advanced research projects would reduce inter-service rivalry by placing federal R&D budgets substantially under his own close supervision. Moreover, it would almost certainly appeal to the President, since the military's often selfish claims and special interest hype usually met with disdain in the White House. Eisenhower liked the Secretary's proposal. While the administration had larger plans in store, the creation of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, passage of a Defense Reorganization Act, establishment of the Office of a Director of Defense Research and Engineering, those things would take time. The Advanced Research Projects Agency concept was a response the President could point to immediately. And it would give him an agile R&D agency he and his scientists could call on in the future. On November 20, 1957, McElroy went to Capitol Hill for the first time as secretary. in the course of testifying about U.S. ballistic missile programs, he mentioned that he had decided to set up a new single manager for all defense research. In the near term, he told Congress, the new agency would handle satellite and space R&D programs. The next day, he circulated to the Joint Chiefs of Staff a draft charter and directive for the new agency, asking for their review and comments. The military bristled at the implied criticism. It was one thing to have civilian science and technological advisors, but McElroy was now clearly invading their turf, planning to manage and operate a central office that would control defense R&D programs and future weapons projects. They were prepared to fight back. The Secretary of the Air Force, James Douglas, wrote, "The Air Force appreciates that the proposals are suggestions." That is, message received, not accepted. The Army, Navy, and Joint Chiefs of Staff returned the draft charter with numerous revisions. They fiddled deviously with language concerning the new agency's contracting authority, their revisions peppered with subversive word changes, crafty additions, and sly deletions, all designed to weaken and confine the agency. McElroy conceded a few minor points, but made two things clear. The agency's director would have contracting authority, and the scope of the agency's research was to be unlimited. On January 7, 1958, Eisenhower sent a message to Congress requesting startup funds for the establishment of the Advanced Research Projects Agency. 2 days later, he drove the point home in his State of the Union message. "I am not attempting today to pass judgment on the charges of harmful service rivalries, but one thing is sure, whatever they are, America wants them stopped." Eisenhower also affirmed the need for single control in some of our most advanced development projects, then delivered his coup de grace to the generals. "Another requirement of military organization is a clear subordination of the military services to the duly constituted civilian authority. This control must be real, not merely on the surface." In early 1958, Roy Johnson, a vice president of General Electric, was appointed ARPA's first director. 5 days after the appointment, funding was approved by Congress as a line item in an Air Force appropriations bill, and ARPA went into business. In the post-Sputnik panic, the race for outer space cut a wide swath through American life, causing a new emphasis on science in the schools, worsening relations between Russia and the United States, and opening a floodgate for R&D spending. Washington's external challenge R&D spending rose from $5 billion per year to over $13 billion annually between 1959 and 1964. Sputnik launched a golden era for military science and technology. By the mid-1960s, the nation's total R&D expenditures would account for 3% of the gross national product, a benchmark that was both a symbol of progress and a goal for other countries. All eyes were on ARPA when it opened its doors with a $520 million appropriation and a $2 billion budget plan. It was given direction over all U.S. space programs and all advanced strategic missile research. By 1959, a headquarters staff of about 70 people had been hired, a number that would remain fairly constant for years. These were mainly scientific project managers, who analyzed and evaluated R&D proposals, supervising the work of hundreds of contractors. Roy Johnson, ARPA's first director, was, like his boss, a businessman. At age 52, he had been personally recruited by McElroy, who convinced him to leave a $160,000 job with General Electric and take an $18,000 job in Washington. Not surprisingly, Johnson approached America's R&D agenda as a management problem. Management skills were his strong suit. His job, as he saw it, was to exhort people to do anything necessary to get the edge on the Soviets. He argued often and vigorously with rooms full of generals and admirals, and aggressively took on the Air Force. It soon became apparent that Johnson was a serious and vociferous advocate of a strong military presence in outer space. But of course Killian and other scientists around Eisenhower had wanted someone well-versed in scientific and technological issues running ARPA. Johnson had been instructed to hire a military flag officer as his deputy, and to select a chief scientist to round out his leadership team. The scientific post had almost gone to Wernher von Braun, until he insisted on bringing his whole team of a dozen associates with him to the Pentagon. So Herbert York, whom Killian had been keen on, was given the job and moved to ARPA from the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. When he arrived on the third floor at the Pentagon, York promptly hung a large picture of the moon on his office wall, and right beside it he hung an empty frame. He told visitors it would soon be filled with the first picture of the backside of the moon. The rest of ARPA's staff was recruited from industry's top-flight technical talent at places like Lockheed, Union Carbide, Convair, and other Pentagon contractors. The staff's days were spent sifting for gold in a torrential flow of unsolicited R&D proposals. ARPA's success hinged on Johnson's extremely vocal posturing about America's role in outer space and his simplistic view of Soviet-American tensions. He mistakenly defined ARPA's mission almost entirely in military terms, outlining the kind of space projects he envisioned: global surveillance satellites, space defense interceptor vehicles, strategic orbital weapon systems, stationary communication satellites, manned space stations, and a moon base. Eisenhower and his civilian scientists had moved ahead with the rest of their agenda, and by the late summer of 1958, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration had been enacted into law. Almost overnight, while Johnson drummed for a military presence in space, the space projects and missile programs were stripped away from ARPA and transferred over to NASA or back to the services, leaving ARPA's budget whittled to a measly $150 million. ARPA's portfolio was gutted, its staff left practically without any role. Aviation Week called the young agency a dead cat hanging in the fruit closet. Johnson resigned. Before leaving, however, he commissioned his staff to draft a paper weighing four alternatives: abolishing ARPA, expanding it, making no changes, or redefining its mission. His analysts threw themselves into building a case for the fourth alternative, and their tenacity alone saved the agency from sure oblivion. They fleshed out a set of goals to distance ARPA from the Pentagon by shifting the agency's focus to the nation's long-term basic research efforts. The services had never been interested in abstract research projects. Their world was driven by near-term goals and cozy relationships with industrial contractors. The staff of ARPA saw an opportunity to redefine the agency as a group that would take on the really advanced, far-out research. Most important of all, ARPA staffers recognized the agency's biggest mistake yet. It had not been tapping the universities where much of the best scientific work was being done. The scientific community, predictably, rallied to the call for a reinvention of ARPA as a high-risk, high-gain research sponsor, the kind of R&D shop they had dreamed of all along. Their dream was realized. ARPA was given its new mission. As ARPA's features took shape, one readily apparent characteristic of the agency was that its relatively small size allowed the personality of its director to permeate the organization. In time, the ARPA style, freewheeling, open to high risk, agile, would be vaunted. Other Washington bureaucrats would come to envy ARPA's modus operandi. Eventually, the agency attracted an elite core of hard-charging R&D advocates from the finest universities and research laboratories, who set about building a community of the best technical and scientific minds in American research. The agency's new basic research and special project orientation was ideally suited to the atmospheric change in Washington caused by the election of John F. Kennedy. With vigor, Washington's bureaucracies responded to the Kennedy charisma. At the Pentagon, Robert S. McNamara, the new Secretary of Defense, led the shift away from the philosophy of massive retaliation in America's strategic posture and toward a strategy of flexible response to international threats to American supremacy. Science was the new frontier. In early 1961, ARPA's second director, Brigadier General Austin W. Betts, resigned and was replaced by Jack P. Ruina, the first scientist to direct ARPA. Ruina came with strong academic credentials as well as some military background. Trained as an electrical engineer, he had been a university professor and had also served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Air Force. He was on good terms with members of the science advisory panels to the White House. A golden era for ARPA was just beginning. Ruina brought a relaxed management style and decentralized structure to the agency. Details didn't interest him. Finding great talent did. He believed in picking the best people and letting them pick the best technology. He felt strongly about giving his program directors free rein. His job, as he saw it, was to build as much support and funding as he could for whatever projects they selected. Ruina had a theory that truly talented people wouldn't normally choose to hang around long in a government bureaucracy, but could be convinced to spend a year or two if offered enough flexibility and large enough budgets. Turnover didn't bother him. The agency, he believed, would benefit from frequent exposure to fresh views. In keeping with all that, he saw himself as a short-timer, too. In time, Ruina raised ARPA's annual budget to $250 million. Projects in ballistic missile defense and nuclear test detection, couched in terms of basic research, were the top priorities. There were also programs like behavioral research and command and control, which, though interesting, fell below the level of Ruina's close attention. Then, in May 1961, a computer, and a very large one at that, demanded Ruina's attention. A program in military command and control issues had been started at ARPA using emergency DOD funds. For the work, the Air Force had purchased the huge, expensive Q-32, a behemoth of a machine that was to act as the backup for the nation's air defense early warning system. The machine had been installed at a facility in Santa Monica, California, at one of the Air Force's major contractors, System Development Corporation, where it was supposed to be used for operator training and as a software development tool. Then the Air Force had been forced to cut back, which left the Santa Monica firm begging for some way to keep its employees working with the computer. The Air Force, which had already sunk millions into the SDC contract, suddenly had an embarrassing white elephant on its hands in the form of one massive, ungainly computing machine. The relationship between the military and computer establishments began with the modern computer industry itself. During World War II, in the midst of a perceived need for faster calculating ability than could be provided by the banks of mechanical calculators run by human operators, the military funded dozens of computing experiments. The Navy supported Howard Aiken, the Harvard mathematics professor who dreamed of building a large-scale calculator and ended up with the Mark I, a 51-foot-long, 8-foot-tall switchboard that could perform arithmetical operations without the intervention of an operator. The Army also supported the famous Electronic Numerical Integrator and Calculator, or ENIAC, project at the University of Pennsylvania. Later, at MIT, first the Navy and then the Air Force supported a computer called Whirlwind. In the early 1950s, computing meant doing arithmetic fast. Companies, especially banks, put their machines to work doing large-scale calculations. In 1953, International Business Machines Corporation, IBM, already the country's largest manufacturer of time clocks, as well as electromechanical tabulating equipment, jumped into the business of making large electronic computers. These were business machines of the future. The IBM machines weren't necessarily better than the UNIVAC, the successor to the ENIAC, but IBM's sales staff became legendary, and before too long, sales of IBM's machines had surpassed those of the UNIVAC. Then, in the late 1950s, just as IBM was passing the billion-dollar sales mark, Ken Olson, an individualistic and outspoken engineer, left MIT's Lincoln Laboratory with $70,000 in venture capital to exploit commercially the technology developed around a new machine, the TX-2 at Lincoln Lab. He formed the Digital Equipment Corporation to manufacture and sell computer components. And then he built something radically different from what had existed before. A smaller computer called a mini-computer that interacted directly with the user. Olson's idea for an interactive computer had come from a pioneering group of computer researchers at MIT. A different and slightly younger group there came up with another dramatic concept in computing that was beginning to catch on, particularly in academic institutions. They called it time-sharing, and it had obvious appeal as an alternative to the slow and awkward traditional method of batch processing. Batch processing was a cumbersome way of computing. For even the smallest programming task, it was necessary to have the relevant code punched onto program cards, which were then combined with control cards to take care of the computer's administrative functions. A computer operator fed the cards into the computer or onto magnetic tape for processing, one batch at a time. Depending on the length of the queue and the complexity of the programs and problems, the wait could be long. It was not unusual to wait a day or longer for results. Time-sharing was, as the term suggests, a new method of giving many users interactive access to computers from individual terminals. The terminals allowed them to interact directly with the mainframe computer. The revolutionary aspect of time-sharing was that it eliminated much of the tedious waiting that characterized batch process computing. Time-sharing gave users terminals that allowed them to interact directly with the computer and obtain their results immediately. "We really believed that it was a better way to operate," recalled Fernando Corbato, an MIT computer scientist. "I suppose if somebody had said, 'I will give you a free machine,' we might have said, 'We do not need time-sharing.' But computers in those days were huge things. They took up large rooms and required continual maintenance, because there were so many components. They were just not a casual thing," Corbato went on. "You did not normally think of having a personal machine in those days. Exclusive use, maybe, but not a personal one. So we really saw a need to try to change that. We were frustrated." The appreciation of time-sharing was directly proportional to the amount of direct access one had to the computer. And usually that meant that the more you programmed, the better you understood the value of direct access. What time-sharing could not do was eliminate the necessity of coordinating competing demands on the machine by different users. By its nature, time-sharing encouraged users to work as if they had the entire machine at their command, when in fact they had only a fraction of the total computing power. Distribution of costs among a number of users meant that the more users the better. Of course, too many users bogged down the machine, since a high percentage of the machine's resources were allocated to coordinating the commands of multiple users. As the number of users increased, more of the computer's resources were dedicated to the coordination function, which reduced actual usable processing time. If programmers had to do very small jobs, such as tightening code or minor debugging of a program, they didn't need a powerful machine. But when it came to run the programs in full, many of which used a lot of machine resources, it became apparent that users were still in competition with one another for computing time. As soon as a large program requiring a lot of calculations entered the mix of jobs being done online, everyone's work slowed down. When the Air Force passed the Q-32 onto ARPA in 1961, Rowena didn't have anyone to administer the contract. Rowena had in mind a job with the potential for expansion far beyond the single contract that happened to be pressing at the moment. Computers, as they related to command and control, might one day provide high-speed, reliable information upon which to base critical military decisions. That potential, largely unfulfilled, seemed endlessly promising. Coincidentally, Rowena also was looking for someone who could direct a new program in behavioral sciences that DOD wanted ARPA to run. By the fall of 1962, Rowena had found the candidate who could fill both posts, an eminent psychologist named J.C.R. Licklider. Licklider was an obvious choice to head a behavioral sciences office, but a psychologist wasn't an obvious choice to oversee a government office focused on developing leading-edge computer technology. Yet Licklider's broad, interdisciplinary interests suited him well for the job. Licklider had done some serious dabbling in computers. "He used to tell me how he liked to spend a lot of time at a computer console," Rowena recalled. "He said he would get hung up on it and become sort of addicted." Licklider was far more than just a computer enthusiast, however. For several years he had been touting a radical and visionary notion, that computers weren't just adding machines. Computers had the potential to act as extensions of the whole human being, as tools that could amplify the range of human intelligence and expand the reach of our analytical powers. Joseph Carl Robnett Licklider was born in St. Louis in 1915. An only and much-beloved child, he spent his early years nurturing a fascination with model airplanes. He knew he wanted to be a scientist, but he was unfocused through most of his college days at Washington University. He switched concentration several times, from chemistry to physics to the fine arts, and finally to psychology. When he graduated in 1937, he held undergraduate degrees in psychology, mathematics, and physics. For a master's thesis in psychology, he decided to test the popular slogan, "Get more sleep, it's good for you," on a population of rats. As he approached his Ph.D., Licklider's interests narrowed toward psychoacoustics, the psychophysiology of the auditory system. For his doctoral dissertation, Licklider studied the auditory cortex of cats, and when he moved to Swarthmore College, he worked on the puzzle of sound localization, attempting to analyze the brain's ability to determine a sound's distance and direction. If you close your eyes and ask someone to snap his fingers, your brain will tell you approximately where the snap is coming from and how far away it is. The puzzle of sound localization is also illustrated by the cocktail party phenomenon. In a crowded room where several conversations are taking place within one's hearing range, it is possible to isolate whatever conversation one chooses by tuning in certain voices and tuning out the rest. In 1942, Licklider went to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to work as a research associate in Harvard University's psychoacoustic laboratory. During the war years, he studied the effects of high altitude on speech communication and the effects of static and other noise on reception by radio receivers. Licklider conducted experiments in B-17 and B-24 bombers at 35,000 feet. The aircraft weren't pressurized, and the temperatures on board were often well below freezing. During one field test, Licklider's colleague and best friend, Carl Kreider, saw Licklider turn white. Kreider panicked. He turned up the oxygen and yelled to his friend, "Lick, speak to me!" Just as Kreider was about to ask the pilot to descend, the color returned to Licklider's face. He had been in tremendous pain, he said, but it had passed. After that, he stopped partaking of his favorite breakfast, Coca-Cola, before going on high-altitude missions. By this time, Licklider had joined the Harvard faculty and was gaining recognition as one of the world's leading theorists on the nature of the auditory nervous system, which he once described as the product of a superb architect and a sloppy workman. Psychology at Harvard in those years was strongly influenced by the behaviorist B.F. Skinner and others, who held that all behavior is learned, that animals are born as blank slates to be inscribed by chance, experience, and conditioning. When Skinner went so far as to put his own child in a so-called Skinner box to test behaviorist theories, and other faculty members began doing similar experiments, albeit less radical ones, Louise Licklider put her foot down. No child of hers was going into a box, and her husband agreed. Louise was usually the first person to hear her husband's ideas. Nearly every evening after dinner, he returned to work for a few hours, but when he got home at around 11 p.m., he usually spent an hour or so telling Louise his latest thoughts. "I grew up on his ideas," she said, "from when the seeds were first planted until, somehow or other, he saw them bear fruit." Everybody adored Licklider, and at his insistence, just about everybody called him Lick. His restless, versatile genius gave rise through the years to an eclectic cult of admirers. Lick stood just over 6 feet tall. He had sandy brown hair and large blue eyes. His most pronounced characteristic was his soft, down-home Missouri accent, which belied his acute mind. When he gave talks or led colloquia, he never prepared a speech. Instead, he would get up and make extensive remarks off the cuff about a certain problem he happened to be working on. Lick's father had been a Baptist minister, and Louise occasionally chided him by noticing the preacher in him. Lick at play with a problem at a briefing or a colloquium, speaking in that soft hillbilly accent, was a tour de force, recalled Bill McGill, a former colleague. He'd speak in this Missouri Ozark twang, and if you walked in off the street, you'd wonder, who the hell is this hayseed? But if you were working on the same problem and listened to his formulation, listening to him would be like seeing the glow of dawn. Many of Lick's colleagues were in awe of his problem-solving ability. He was once described as having the world's most refined intuition. "He could see the resolution of a technical problem before the rest of us could calculate it," said McGill. "This made him rather extraordinary." Lick was not a formalist in any respect, and seldom struggled with arcane theorems. "He was like a wide-eyed child going from problem to problem, consumed with curiosity. Almost every day he had some new fillip on a problem we were thinking about." But living with Lick had its frustrations, too. He was humble, many believed, to a fault. He often sat in meetings tossing ideas out for anyone to claim. "If someone stole an idea from him," Louise recalled, "I'd pound the table and say, 'It's not fair,' and he'd say, 'It doesn't matter who gets the credit, it matters that it gets done.'" Throughout the many years he taught, he inspired all his students, even his undergraduates, to feel like junior colleagues. His house was open to them, and students often showed up at the front door with a chapter of a thesis or just a question for him. "I'd put my thumb up and they'd pound up to his third-floor office," said Louise. In the post-war years, psychology was still a young discipline, inviting derision from those in the harder sciences with little patience for a new field that dealt with such enigmatic entities as the mind, or the human factor. But Licklider was a psychologist in the most rigorous sense. As one colleague put it, he belonged with those whose self-conscious preoccupation with the legitimacy of their scientific activity has made them more tough-minded than a good many of their colleagues in the better-established fields. By 1950, Lick had moved to MIT to work in the Institute's acoustics laboratory. In the following year, when MIT created Lincoln Laboratory as a research lab devoted to air defense, Lick signed on to start the laboratory's human engineering group. The Cold War had come to dominate virtually the entire intellectual life of the institution. Lincoln Lab was one of the most visible manifestations of MIT's Cold War alliance with Washington. In the early 1950s, many military theoreticians feared a surprise attack by Soviet bombers carrying nuclear weapons over the North Pole. And just as scientists had coalesced during the 1940s to deal with the possibility of German nuclear armament, a similar team gathered in 1951 at MIT to deal with the perceived Soviet threat. Their study was called Project Charles. Its outcome was a proposal to the Air Force for a research facility devoted to the task of creating technology for defense against aerial attack. Thus, Lincoln Laboratory was quickly formed, staffed, and set to work under its first director, the physicist Albert Hill. In 1952, the lab moved off campus to Lexington, about 10 miles west of Cambridge. Its main project centered around the concept of distant early warning, the dew line, arrays of radar stretching ideally from Hawaii to Alaska, across the Canadian archipelago to Greenland, and finally to Iceland and the British Isles. Problems of communication, control, and analysis for such an extended, complex structure could be handled only by a computer. To satisfy that requirement, Lincoln first took on Whirlwind, a computer project at MIT, and then developed a successor project called the Semi-Automatic Ground Environment, or SAGE. Based on a large IBM computer, SAGE was so mammoth that its operators and technicians literally walked inside the machine. The system served three major functions: receiving data from various detection and tracking radars, interpreting data relating to unidentified aircraft, and pointing defensive weapons at incoming hostile aircraft. SAGE was only semi-automatic, since the human operator remained an important part of the system. In fact, SAGE was one of the first fully operational, real-time interactive computer systems. Operators communicated with the computer through displays, keyboard switches, and light guns. Users could request information from the computer and receive an answer within a few seconds. New information continuously flowed directly into the computer's memory through telephone lines to the users, making it immediately available to the operators. The SAGE system inspired a few thinkers, including Licklider, to see computing in an entirely new light. SAGE was an early example of what Licklider would later call the symbiosis between humans and machines, where the machine functions as a problem-solving partner. Implied in this symbiotic relationship was the interdependency of humans and computers working in unison as a single system. For instance, in a battle scenario, human operators without computers would be unable to calculate and analyze threats quickly enough to counter an attack. Conversely, computers working alone would be unable to make crucial decisions. In 1953, MIT decided to start a human factors group in the psychology section of the economics department, and Lick was put in charge. He recruited a handful of his brightest students and colleagues. Lick hired people based not on their doctoral work or class standing, but on a simple test he applied, the Miller Analogies Test. The test covers every field from geology to history and the arts. It requires both good general knowledge and an ability to apply that knowledge to relationships. "I had a kind of a rule," he said. "Anybody who could do 85 or better on the Miller Analogies Test, hire him, because he's going to be very good at something." In 1954, Lick's group moved in with the social psychologists and labor management experts in the Sloan School of Management. But the group's ideas were far removed from management problems. As McGill, an early Licklider recruit, described it, he and his peers were far more interested in computers and computer memory devices as models for the versatility of human cognition. The first dissertation produced by the department under Lick's guidance came from Ph.D. candidate Tom Merrill, who had examined the subject of ideal auditory detection. Like others who came into Licklider's sphere, Merrill would make his mark on the development of computer networking in years to come. "Nothing like this had ever been seen before, at least not in a psychology department," said McGill. The department was the first cognitive science department in history. The work was experimentally based on cognitive psychology, as it would be defined today, but at the time we had no proper language or nomenclature. But eventually, MIT administrators wanted something more traditional, and Lick failed in his efforts to expand his new department with permanent appointments. As a result, all his protégés, young and marketable, drifted off. "We did not have the sophistication to promote what we did, and we were unaware that there was anything unique about it. So MIT let it all slip away," McGill said. Lick was a maverick after all, and a little far out, perhaps too much so for MIT. Yet Lick did not lament the demise of the group, for he had a self-professed short attention span. His interests changed often and dramatically over the years. He once advised a young friend never to sign on for a project that lasted more than 5 to 7 years, so he could always move on to other things. And anything Lick got interested in, he plunged into great depth. Perhaps the incident that most piqued Lick's interest in computers and their potential as interactive instruments was an encounter he had in the 1950s with a smart, opinionated young engineer at Lincoln Labs named Wesley Clark. Clark was a young researcher working on the TX-2 machine, the state-of-the-art in digital computation and the successor to a computer called the TX-0. Clark had built the TX-0 with Ken Olson before Olson left to start Digital Equipment Corporation. Clark's office was in the Lincoln basement. One day, on his way back from the stockroom at the other end of the corridor, Clark decided to venture into a room that had always seemed vaguely off-limits. Most lab doors stood open, but not this one. It was always closed. Clark tried the door, which he was surprised to find unlocked, and entered the room. "I wandered in and back through a little labyrinth of baffles and barriers," Clark recalled. "Off to one side was this very dark laboratory, and I went in.